Hello, this is David Rovics, hosting another live stream broadcast, which is appearing on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KBOO Community Radio, and various other platforms. During the pandemic, since I can no longer tour and play music for a living, I've taken to broadcasting most every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT. On Mondays, it's an open mic, which I call Pandemic Open Mic Mondays, which folks are encouraged to sign up to participate in at davidrovics.com/POMM. Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays, I've taken to interviewing my friends for the most part and sort of publicly catching up with people who I might otherwise be hanging out with physically on a typical tour if such things were still happening. On Tuesdays, however, the broadcast has an actual producer, longtime Detroit area talk show host and Fifth Estate Magazine editorial collective member, Peter Werby. These days, Fifth Estate is a quarterly print magazine that has been published in one form or another since its founding in 1965. You can read the entirety of the spring issue online at fifthestate.org. You can also subscribe to the print magazine there and hear various previous episodes of, Fifth Estate Live. I can't read my own writing and it's not even writing. You can hear previous episodes of Fifth Estate Live as well at fifthestate.org. Today's guest is Bill Weinberg, longtime journalist and author from New York City and regular contributor to the Fifth Estate magazine. In the upcoming summer issue, his article is titled Two Faces of Fascism. Bill is the co-editor of countervortex.org, where you can find lots more of his writing. Books he's published include Tompkins Square Park, Avant Gardening, and Homage to Chiapas. Bill Weinberg, welcome to Fifth Estate Live.
Hey.
Hey, this, we could just like jump right into the fire since it's like kind of the only thing to do these days, it seems. And this article that you got coming up is fascinating. And I want to read both of those books that you review in the article, neither of which I've read. But you write, the threat persists of an imminent state of exception in the U.S. with basic rights completely abrogated and perhaps the election postponed, suspended, or canceled. In short, the establishment of the dictatorship that Trump has clearly been dreaming of since 2016. I know I'm just like dropping in midway through your article, but can you just riff on that and tell us what you're about the premise of the possible forms of fascism that might be coming?
Yeah, well... I mean, the country is already in crisis, quite obviously. I should start by mentioning my big bushy white beard, which I'm extremely self-conscious about, actually. Now I'm actually before a live audience here looking crazy. And
I love the beard, but you didn't have a beard on your website. That's a new pandemic development. That's a pandemic beard.
My beard is related to the crisis because I shave my head every day. And I get the beard trimmed once a week at a barber down in Chinatown, and everything has been closed since March. So I've been only shaving the mustache, not the head and the beard, just to conserve razor blades. And I haven't been going to my barber because she's closed. Yeah. So I look much crazier and older than I actually am.
Yeah, I noticed you're only born a few years before me, and I suddenly realized I really am in my 50s. You know what? My hair, I've also haven't gone to a barber in 3 months. Just bought a razor, a shaver thing, but I haven't used it yet.
But we could be in a much bigger crisis before November, is my fear. And I think it's pretty obvious from Trump's actions that he's actually trying to foment it. And he's hoping that, he can use it to either throw the election in his favor or actually cancel or suspend the election. I mean, he's obviously, it's been obvious from all of his rhetoric and all of his actions ever since 2015 when he announced that, he is salivating to establish a dictatorship. He wants to be the Mussolini of America. I don't see how you can possibly miss this. Yeah. He hasn't yet been able to get away with this. Like, democracy is hanging by a hair. Now, the outward forms of, formalistic bourgeois democracy. That's all I mean. It's hanging by a hair in this country at the moment, okay?
And as you write, it's maybe the military brass that is largely what stands between.
Right. Which is, yeah. Well, I think, his first real effort to try to escalate things to the point where he could, you know, declare martial law and, you know, abrogate constitutional rights, et cetera, was about a month ago with the thing, the big climax that we saw down at Lafayette Square in Washington, D.C., where actual military troops were used. And Miley, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was on the scene directing things dressed in camo. And there was a big outcry about this. And in the immediate aftermath, both Miley and Mark Esper, the Secretary of Defense, and Mattis, the former Secretary of Defense, all issued statements saying that no, the military should not be used for domestic enforcement. And I think that this was due to rumblings of mutiny in the ranks, you know, percolating up to the brass, who, you know, sat down with Miley and Esper and had a little talk with them and said, troops may refuse to obey orders for domestic repression. And remember the old military maxim, never give an order you're afraid may not be obeyed, because that's when authority begins to break down entirely. And that's obviously something that they very, very much wish to avoid. So I think that, you know, it's actually the Pentagon, which has probably been telling Trump that, you know, no, we don't have your back. If you try to pull any monkey business, we're not going to back you up. And I think that's restrained him. And I think maybe, obviously, I'm not privy to what's going on in the corridors of power, but maybe that had to do with why he sort of blinked on Tulsa, the second opportunity that he had to try to cement something after Lafayette Square was Tulsa, where he, his big comeback rally after the country was basically, the economy was suspended and all that due to the pandemic. And now, of course, you know, they opened way too soon, way too precipitously. And that could just, you know, be completely self-defeating. They're going to have to lock down again if the virus continues to spread. But in any event, he was going to have this big triumphalist rally. He chose the date of Juneteenth, which is the holiday which celebrates Black emancipation in this country. And he chose the city of Tulsa, which in 1923, of course, was the scene of a generalized massacre of the African-American community in that city.
Yeah, 1921. Yeah.
21. Okay, forgive me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the very successful and well-established Black community, you know, they actually called it Black Wall Street, and it was burnt to the ground by white supremacist mobs and militias back in 1921. Right, it was 21.
And it seems Trump is, you write also that Trump has really been waiting for a Reichstag fire moment or like a 9/11 moment, right? And he's just not getting it, right? He's not getting one.
At the 11th hour, he blinked and he actually, he kept the rally in Tulsa, but he actually held it a day later. He actually held it on June 20th rather than June 19th. So it wasn't actually on Juneteenth. So it was less of a provocation.
And if he was provoking some kind of a response by having a rally on Juneteenth, and as you write it, the prospect of some kind of a uprising requiring troops to put it down, then the possibility is there, of course, that the troops wouldn't want to put down such an uprising, exactly. Particularly when you consider how many of the troops are Black and brown. Like that. This is not the police force. Yeah. But the other thing is also that you write about, I think, very interesting stuff about how Trump is not a very well organized fascist in the sense that he didn't actually have a sort of a brown shirt movement prior to his election. So he's really kind of lacking a certain element of taking power through.
Right. I think one of the things which is saved formalistic democracy, at least in this country for the past 4 years, is Trump's own incompetence. Yeah. You know, he's got the dictatorial ambitions and he's got a certain, Mussolini-like charisma, you know, when he's playing to his crowd, but he doesn't have, he's not a competent organizer. That is not. He hasn't been able to get his paramilitary force together, his black shirts or his brown shirts, so to speak. But my fear is that now maybe that's starting to come together, especially, you know, the way he's been able to exploit, you know, the backlash against the lockdown measures among, you know, the white middle class. A lot of them have actually, especially as we've seen most dramatically in Michigan, but it's not just Michigan, it's elsewhere in the country as well. You actually are starting to see a lot of these people get armed now. And you actually are starting to see the beginnings of a right-wing militia movement in this country, such as we saw in the 1990s, beginning to reemerge again. There isn't any mechanism of command. They're loyal to Trump, but they're not actually, there isn't any mechanism of command, but that may yet emerge. And it's definitely mm-hmm. something to be very concerned about.
And also, as much as Trump it keeps on clearly trying to provoke some kind of a 9/11 moment, it just keeps on not happening, right? It's just, I mean, he's been waiting for it, hoping for it, and it's just not coming along.
Thus far.
We still got several months till November.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And even beyond November, he's still going to be in office. Even if the election goes ahead and it's a normal election.
Breaking up a little bit there. You're in New York City where they're supposed to have good internet. But let's see what's happening. Come back, Bill. Hopefully the technical issues can be resolved. What's going on here? I blame the NSA. Bill, let's see. I don't know. Well, we'll try to. We'll hope that he can come back somehow. He can click that link, and hopefully he comes back. You're listening to Fifth Estate Live, which comes to you every Tuesday on various platforms, including the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KABU Community Radio. You can find all the episodes archived in audio form at fifthestate.org, where you can also subscribe to the Fifth Estate print magazine. We're talking with longtime journalist and author from New York City, Bill Weinberg, who is currently, hopefully, trying to get back to the show. We can maybe just do an audio connection if there's issues with the video, although that seemed to be working just fine right up until the time that he vanished. Let's see.
Are we back?
Hey, it was all... Yeah, it was, and everything was just fine. The audio and video was perfect right up until the time where it just like totally crapped out. So, but I don't know. Now it seems to be fine again. I don't know. Yeah, New York
well,
City.
I mean,
has pretty good Wi-Fi usually.
This technical glitch. Go ahead.
Maybe try to.
Can you hear me?
Now you're breaking up again. Try turning off the video. Maybe we can just do audio. Maybe that's going to be better. If that's going to be,
can you hear me?
You're breaking up and your image is freezing. So can you try just turning off the video and we'll just do audio. Let's see, Bill, if you can hear me, try just turning off the video.
I can hear you, but you can't hear me.
Can you turn off the video?
I don't know how to do that. How do I do that?
Let's see.
I'm trying to figure out how to do that. See, I knew this was going to be easy.
Yeah, I know. Because it was working fine before. Yeah. Now it's, yeah. I mean,
Hang on a minute. Let me try it in. Hang on a minute.
Now you're back, both video and audio.
Let me try it in Chrome.
Well, it could be just turning off the video.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. But
how do I do that?
Yeah.
Should I try Chrome? Let me try Chrome.
You could try Chrome,
Let me try Chrome. Hang on a minute.
Might help. Okay. We'll get Bill back here on another browser. Maybe that will work better. But the browser also might not be the issue. But we'll see. So, but while we're waiting for Bill to come back, I could read you some of his article. But here we go. Let's see.
See me? Can you hear me?
Let's see. Yeah, I can hear you and see you.
Good. Maybe Chrome will work.
Maybe that could be. Yeah. And everything else on the computer, close all other, anything else you have open on the computer, close all that.
Oh, well, that's kind of difficult.
Yeah, that could be the thing too. But anyway, we hear from somebody in London says we can hear and see you in London. So I guess anyway, you're working. It's working
hi,
now.
Hi, London.
And Lewis Ward says hi.
Technical problems actually bring us to the second face of dystopia, which I discuss in my piece, which is going to appear in Fifth Estate. I call it two faces of fascism. One of them is the more classically, obviously fascist, you know, the Trump fascism, you know, that model. And the other is that, you know, even in the best case scenario, we managed to avoid Trump fascism. We're still going to be looking at, you know, this post-pandemic normality where, you know, everything is going to be done remotely over programs like, what's the name of this program?
It's got Fifth Estate Live. Which one?
No.
Oh, StreamYard. Yeah, all these platforms. This dystopia. Yeah, who knows who's listening or what's going on or who else is listening? Exactly. And this book sounds fantastic. This 1909 book. It sounds like it's predicting now.
Yes, exactly. Let me talk about the two books.
Please.
There's two books actually. You know, both written by dead white guys back in the 20th century, which works of future fiction, which were, just amazingly predictive of the actual social reality, which is unfolding around us today. One of them is It Can't Happen Here by Sinclair Lewis, written in 1935, which was his vision of what it would look like in the United States if a figure like Hitler or Mussolini took power here. And his fictional dictator is named Buzz Windrip, and the parallels between Buzz Windrip and Trump are absolutely amazing, both in their style and in their rhetoric, as well as in the mechanisms that they've been using, and the social tensions and racism that they've been exploiting to climb to power. The other work is The Machine Stops by E.M. Foster. And E.M. Foster is better known for, A Room with a View and Passage to India. But this is one of his really early writings back in 1909. It's kind of a novella where he actually predicted the internet. Way back in 1909, he predicted the internet and he predicted social distances, distancing and distance learning. And the world has been... The human race has been forced indoors by some kind of unnamed disaster, which makes the surface of the world uninhabitable, and everybody lives in underground cells, isolated individual underground cells, and they communicate to each other through this vast network that goes all over the world, which he calls the machine, and basically it's the internet, and everybody communicates through. This audio telephony kind of thing, such as what we are using right now. And it's quote unquote good enough that people, accept it as a substitute for quote unquote, real life. I use quotation marks a lot. Peter Werbe, my editor at Fifth Estate, quotation marks. But I fear that that's what we're going to, even in the best case scenario, we managed to avoid an openly fascist, classically fascist situation in this country. We're still going to be, even under a President Biden, we're still going to be looking at this kind of dystopia where everything, all human activity is going to be relegated to cyberspace, which means that it's all going to be subject to total surveillance. And these models for safely reopening the economy are all going to entail intimate tracking of the populace. They're going to download an app onto your cell phone. I don't carry a cell phone. I think I'm the last guy in America who doesn't carry a cell phone. I refuse to.
But and isn't it amazing how, I mean, just as a little tangent there, I mean, you know, I know one of the things you've written about quite a bit is the situation Israel-Palestine. And the one of the main ways that the Israeli Defense Forces do targeted assassinations is by tracking the cell phone signals of Palestinians. Like, if that's not enough to get everybody to stop using cell phones, you know, but, you know, we're mostly
right. And the Israeli Security Service, Shin Bet, that notoriously used technology and methodology that they developed for, you know, tracking Palestinian militants. They actually applied that to the general Israeli populace in terms of, you know, tracking the social contacts of the people in order to stop the virus. So that very same, you know, those very same methods were ostensibly developed to fight quote unquote terrorists were applied generally in the name of stopping the virus, applied to society generally in the name of containing the virus. And, you know, even in nice liberal democracies like New Zealand, they're now creating their a special antivirus police corps to track the movements of the populace. And they've actually empowered to carry out warrantless raids on the homes of suspected quarantine violators. So, you know, this is going to be, even if we're lucky enough to dodge the bullet of Trump fascism, we're going to be looking at this other dystopia, which is why I call my piece Two Faces of Fascism, which is kind of a play on the book Three Faces of Fascism by Eric Nolte. I mean, the second one, the post-pandemic cybernetic totalitarianism, it's not exactly fascism, okay? I'm using the term a little bit loosely there. What Trump is trying to do, it really is, you know, almost on the model of classical 1930s, 1940s fascism, Hitler and Mussolini. The other model isn't exactly, but it is a form of totalitarian social control. It's what's been called friendly fascism. There was actually a book by that name that came out back in the Reagan era. I can't remember the author offhand. I've got it on my bookshelf somewhere. I read it a long time ago. Now, you could argue that, you know, friendly fascism, fascism which is not motivated by, you know, an ugly ultra-nationalist ideology and by ethnic hatred, but, you know, merely concern for public security and public health. You could, you know, that kind of fascism, you could argue that it's not really fascism, classically defined, and that, you know, friendly fascism is an oxymoron. Fascism by its nature is not friendly. But so I'm using the term a little bit loosely for that second category, but they are both, you know, threats to human freedom without a doubt.
Like a total control sort of situation. And whether it's friendly or not kind of depends on who's in charge, but the total autocracy is there.
You got it. It depends on who's in charge precisely. And, you know, ultimately another thing that I say in my piece is that, you know, right now Trump has been steering up his base by exploiting the backlash against the social restrictions imposed in the name of containing the virus. But he could flip on that in a minute. And if he fails to get his Reichstag fire between now and November, he could suddenly decide that, yeah, the virus really is a threat and actually use the virus as, you know, his crisis to lubricate his dictatorship. So Trump could flip on that, you know, just overnight. And we could get the worst of both worlds. We could get both models of fascism.
That's right. There's another third option. Bill, I wonder, like, one of the things that's now, I mean, one of the things that's now being talked about in the finance press, on Marketplace and Yahoo Finance, on various Business Insider, all kinds of places. I get these notifications on my phone, you know, and they are all talking about the possibility of 20 to 28 million evictions being carried out between now and September in this country. And you've got a lot of background resisting evictions in various forms. And I would say that the whole movement in the Lower East Side in the 80s was in many ways all about resisting gentrification and waves of evictions and everything else. Can you talk about that and I think how it plays into the holding of public space is another, I think, sort of feature of successful struggles and struggles that you've been involved with, like around Tompkins Square Park and guerrilla gardening. And this is not a question. It's just more an open-ended, like, talk about that, would you?
Sure. Well, before the shutdown, for the past several years, I've been doing a radical history walking tour of the Lower East Side for the Museum of Reclaimed Urban Space, which was actually a museum which we established on the ground floor of C Squat, one of the legendary squats on the Lower East Side, established back in the 1980s. A museum which, you know, was actually dedicated to documenting. It still exists. I think it's just reopening now, although I haven't resumed the tours. A museum dedicated to documenting the whole struggle which took place on the Lower East Side back in the 1980s, actually even before, beginning in the 70s and continuing on into the early 90s. That was really the peak of it, when a lot of land had been abandoned during the urban crisis of the 1970s, when the city was in total disarray, and real estate prices were very depressed. And a lot of land was just abandoned by the landlords, and a lot of vacant lots and empty buildings around the neighborhood. And a lot of the vacant lots were reclaimed initially by Puerto Rican folk in the neighborhood as community gardens. And we still have the highest proportion of community gardens, I believe, of any neighborhood in the country here in the Lower East Side. And then following that, in the 1980s, a lot of the abandoned buildings were reclaimed by squatters, you know, young kids just moving in and fixing them up and taking them over. And during this period, I was kind of involved in this movement. I technically was not a squatter. I had lots of friends who were squatters, but the building where I'm living now, I'm still living in the same apartment, but I moved into back then. When I moved in back then, the building had essentially been abandoned by the landlord. So we were on rent strike because the landlord wasn't doing any upkeep and there wasn't any heat or hot water. And so we were, it was like almost squatting. The difference between squatting and being on rent strike is, you know, you're squatting when you move into a building which has already been abandoned and take it over and start to fix it up. You're on rent strike when, you know, you've been living in the building when the landlord abandons it and stops doing any upkeep and you stop paying your rent, because the landlord isn't, you know, isn't doing any upkeep. So that's the situation that I was in. Eventually, in my own building, we won in court against the landlord, and the building was taken away from the landlord by the city. And at that point, we had the opportunity, we meaning the residents of the building, the tenants council, we had the ability, this was going back to 1993, something like that, we had the ability to actually take the building over as a co-op. And I kind of regret that we failed to at the time. We were just organized enough to win our rent strike against the landlord. But then once the building was up for grabs, we sort of started, you know, the factionalism began to emerge in the tenants council. We started fighting amongst ourselves, and eventually the city got tired of dealing with us and they said, okay, we're just going to flip it to a new landlord, which they did. So now I'm just, paying rent to a landlord. But you're probably aware that in New York City, you know, your rent goes up by an increment every time you sign a new lease. And I didn't get a new lease for the years that we were on rent strike. So I still have very, very low rent.
Because of rent control. Because the building you live in was built before 1947, right? Which means it's under rent control legislation. Whereas the buildings built post-1947 in New York City, there's no rent control at all? I mean, is it no rent control on those buildings? Or is it just less? The rents, as people, everybody knows how crazy the rents are in New York City for many people. But then I don't know how many people are aware that for many other people, the rent is very good in New York City. It just totally depends on whether the building is built after or before.
Well, it's a rather complicated system. There's actually rent control and then there's rent stabilization. I think stabilization came in after 47. Before that, it was control. I think that's how. So I'm technically rent stabilized. I don't think there's anybody left in the building now who's still rent control. I think the last of them died a few years ago. When you're rent control, your rent doesn't go up at all. It's kind of frozen. When you're rent stabilized, every time you sign a new lease, the rent goes up by a certain increment. But my rent didn't go up for a period of like 5 years because we were on rent strike. So my rent is like disgracefully low by the standards of New York City today, which is why I can get away with living as a freelance writer. So
yeah, right. Of course. And you have, it gives you so much possibility to actually do all sorts of things with your life rather than working two jobs to, yeah, try to pay exactly. the rent.
So, so I was covering this whole squatter scene as a young journalist back in the day, back in the 1980s. And, you know, it's amazing how, because to us, we kind of felt like particularly, probably like 25 buildings were under occupation by squatters on the Lower East Side in this period. And finally, the whole thing came to a head with the Tompkins Square riot of 1988, where, you know, there was a tremendous crisis of homelessness in New York City at this time. Because first of all, this housing stock had been destroyed during the landlord arson and abandonment of the 1970s. And then with the beginnings of the economic recovery, there I go again with quotation marks, in the 1980s, working people couldn't keep pace with the rising rents. And there was a second wave of displacement. So obviously, you know, the economic recovery was not an economic recovery for the working people of the Lower East Side. Just the opposite. It hurt them economically because they weren't getting the jobs. They had lost their jobs in the industrial sector, which was gutted. And they, were not getting the new jobs in the service economy, you know, and down on Wall Street and so on, which were being created. So people were being displaced by gentrification in this period. So in the summer of 1988, the long, hot summer of 1988, the homeless moved into Tompkins Square Park and established an encampment there. And what happened immediately is that the local squatters in the neighborhood came to them and said, okay, we support your right to be here. If the police try to evict you, we'll defend you. So immediately it turned into a protest encampment where they say, you know, they weren't just hiding out from the cops and hoping not to be noticed, as in many, you know, homeless encampments around the city at that time. But they were saying, okay, we are Tent City. This park is under occupation and we're not going anywhere until the city does something to provide some dignified housing for the homeless. But of course, the city administration under the ultra reactionary mayor, Ed Koch, responded by imposing a curfew in the park. Up till this point, all the parks in New York City have been open 24/7. Nobody ever thought to close them. Mm-hmm. But now Ed Koch says, OK, all the parks are going to close at 1 o'clock in the morning, starting with Tompkins Square. And the local anarchists say, no, we're not. And squatters say, no, we're not going to have this. We're going to resist the curfew. And on the first night that the curfew was to be enforced, August 6th, 1988, the obvious happened. Avenue A, right outside the park, filled up with riot police, with their helmets and their shields and their full-on gear ready to rock and roll. And Tompkins Square filled up with anarchists wearing bicycle crash helmets and armed with, shields they'd improvised from garbage can lids and rocks and bottles and bricks that they'd been saving for the occasion. And sure enough, the obvious happened. The police came in and tried to clear out the park. The anarchists fought back and it exploded into what we still call today the Tompkins Square Park riot, although there had been some before and there were many after that in the 3 years that followed. So this was the beginning of what we call, the class war period on the Lower East Side. Sometimes I call it the Lower East Side Intifada.
Nice.
Lower East Side is like the Puerto Rican rendering rendering of Lower East Side. So we called it the Lower East Side Intifada. And it ended finally with the new administration of David Dinkins, who had been elected as a liberal, saying he was going to, help the homeless, but really never did very much. Finally, at a certain point, he said enough is enough, and he ordered the park closed entirely. So the park was closed for 2 years. And when it was open, 2 years later in 93, the curfew was enforced. It's now actually a midnight curfew, an hour earlier than the original curfew. And during those 2 years that the park was closed, the protest movement in the neighborhood did not have any place to meet and gather because, the park had sort of become the focal point of the whole protest movement. So it was gutted. It was finished. And in the years after that, there were a lot of squatter evictions. The homeless were cleared out and the whole neighborhood got very, very aggressively and rapidly gentrified. Resistance began to reemerge in the late 1990s, or the whole struggle to save the community gardens on the Lower East Side, because at a certain point they said, okay, now, you know, we've conquered enough territory that we can start clearing out these community gardens. And one by one, they were slated to be bulldozed. So there was a lot of protest about that in the late 1990s, more, less nihilist and less, less, really hardcore anarchist and more kind of, green and environmentalist in its sensitivity. But, they locked down to the trees in the gardens, just like, the radical environmentalists out west were locking down to the old growth forest in the Rockies and, standing up to the bulldozers. We were doing the same kind of thing here on the Lower East Side. And
the different character of those two movements, it strikes me that they were largely, that when you described the more hardcore anarchist the thing and then the locking down like Earth First kind of thing later, these movements were both happening in the context of the world, right? So the Low East Side Intifada, I mean, this is happening at the same time as the First Intifada.
That's right.
In Palestine, and also at the same time as there's a real rise in the sort of autonomous movement in Germany and Denmark and other parts of Europe, which was very much this black-clad anarchist street fighter. Yeah. Yeah. Ethos, right?
Right.
And,
yep.
Yeah. And then later with the global justice movement that was happening in the late 90s, it took more of that character, didn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So the relationship between the squatter movement and the movement to hold on to Tompkins Square Park and gentrification. I mean, really, the gentrification that took over the whole of Manhattan really was really delayed for years and by that movement in many ways. I mean, it was such a present movement on the streets, wasn't it? And people in the neighborhood who were not from the sort of black clad anarchist crowd understood that. I mean, it was a widespread understanding that this movement there was good for everybody who didn't want gentrification. Was that what you're saying? Or am I simplifying too much?
You might be simplifying a little bit there. The neighborhood became divided at a certain point. That was one of the ways that the city was able to get away with what it got away with in 91 when they closed the park. I mean, even the movement at a certain point became divided between the really, hardcore bottle-throwing faction. And even, it got to the point of throwing M80s at the police. It started to get really heavy. And those, and particularly after they closed the park, there was a real kind of dividing line which emerged where between those who were more interested in just, escalating tactics to the point of, total war with the police, and those who believed in going a more traditional community organizing route and actually, trying to build alliances with other community institutions which were less hardcore, to the churches and so on in the neighborhood, and get everybody on board on the same page of demanding that the park be reopened. And I'll admit I fell into the latter faction there. I was in the more quote-unquote moderate camp at that point, so I felt there was a tactical error to hang on to the at that juncture to hang on to the brick throwing tactic. So yeah, there was a lot of controversy and a lot of division in the neighborhood, and even within the movement, as well as there were those outside the movement who began to view it rather dimly. It has to be said. But in any event, very very much the goal of the movement was to make the neighborhood an unfriendly place for the gentrifiers. And it was even one of the more extremist or nihilist slogans which was going around at the time was "Mug a yuppie."
Yeah, so, right. Yeah, it's especially with and then gentrification has become so much worse since then that I mean, exactly. At the time,
people ask me why today I talk about some of the we lost our community center. Charas, was a real, it was a school building in the neighborhood, a really historically important school building built something like 120 years ago, which was abandoned during the urban blight and was initially squatted by Puerto Rican activists in the 1970s, and eventually they got site control of the building. And Charas became really historically significant because, you know, back in those early days, back in the late 70s, early 80s, it was still kind of a divide in the neighborhood between the older Puerto Rican residents who were there first and really spearheaded, you know, taking over abandoned properties for community guarding and stuff like that. And, you know, the young white, mostly white, not all of the squatters were white by any means, but a lot of them were white. So the young white, you know, anarchist and punk element that started moving into, like me, started moving into the neighborhood at that time. There was kind of, you know, some suspicion between those two groups at first. Charas was the first place where those two groups really came together and learned how to get along with each other and actually built some trust and some solidarity. And it was a very, very important community institution. A lot of really, really important, you know, activist and artistic and theatrical projects went on out of Charas over the years on 9th Street, just off of Tompkins Square Park. And in, I believe it was the year 2000, it was evicted by the Giuliani administration. So that was a real blow. And people ask me, you know, now the building is still standing there vacant. There's been litigation and so on to stop them from actually, to stop the new developer from actually destroying the building, which is what he initially wanted to do, and putting up a luxury high rise. We've been able to stop him from doing that in the courts, basically. And we got the building landmarked by the City Landmarks Commission because it's historically significant, so he can't destroy it. So it's still sitting there vacant. And people ask me, you know, when I point out the building on the tour, why people don't break in and start squatting it again. And the difference is that in the 1970s, you could get away with that kind of thing because, you know, all this property had been abandoned all around the city, particularly around the Lower East Side, you know, in quote unquote, you know, poor neighborhoods like the Lower East Side. And there was just all this land up for grabs. So there wasn't any high, you know, premium on real estate at that time. Today, it's just the opposite. Today, real estate prices have been ridiculously inflated for more than a generation. So, you know, it isn't like, you know, there's all this abandoned property, which is ripe for the picking. And, you know, you could try to break into Charas and you'd be evicted immediately. So, but now, you know, one wonders at the current state of crisis.
Right.
If, you know, we might not be going into a new social reality here, and you know, windows of possibility are going to begin to open again. Let's put it that way.
All kinds of windows, huh? I mean, with this many people facing possible eviction, and with what was it? I believe where did I just read that the one basically 47% of working age people in the U.S. are currently not working. So like, I mean, when we, you know, so how they define unemployment rate and all that, I mean, maybe lots of them maybe don't want to be working, don't need to be working. But anyway, it's a huge, huge, however we slice it, it's a massive situation here in terms of poverty and imminent eviction. And when these suspensions on evictions end, and with all these people, you know, organizing rent strikes or talking about rent strike or just not paying the rent, you know, it's just hard. I can't picture. I mean, I'm trying to over here doing some organizing around trying to prepare for that, for the wave of evictions that's coming and
develop
a response network. Portland. Yeah. We have a suspension on evictions in Oregon that's just been extended till the end of September, which I think is, I think Oregon is generally doing the best job of kicking the can down the road, but not actually, you know, solving the problem, just delaying the, well, what seems to be the inevitable. I don't know, but it's, yeah. Well, just you're listening to Fifth Estate Live, which comes to you every Tuesday on various platforms, including the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KBOO Community Radio. You can find all the episodes archived in audio form at fifthestate.org, where you can also subscribe to the Fifth Estate print magazine. We're talking with journalist and author from New York City, Bill Weinberg. Bill, there's a lot of people talking about defunding the police lately. It's and here in Oregon, the legislature is actually talking about decriminalizing all drugs.
Yeah. I know. That's amazing. Yeah, it's great.
Can we talk about the relevance of drugs and drug illegalization to this whole policing? You've written a lot about that as well.
Yeah, well, that's actually my bread and butter. Writing about cannabis is primarily how I make my living. I write for Cannabis Now magazine and Project CBD. I used to be an editor at High Times magazine. So writing about cannabis has always been my bread and butter, actually. And, you know, I mean, more than ever, I think it's becoming clear that, you know, cannabis is actually a serious political issue. You know, I've done the math. On any given day in this country, there might be 100,000 people behind bars for cannabis. You're talking about people who are actually serving time, probably comes to around 40,000. And then you've got, you know, on any given day, you've got more than twice as many who are, you know, probably behind bars waiting to see the judge after having been popped. So, you know, when you've got 100,000 people behind bars, that's not just, you know, an issue for white stoners. OK, that's a serious political issue, which is very, very intimately tied to all the basic questions of, you know, racial and social justice, which the country is now grappling with. And to me, one of the most inspiring things which is going on right now is that, you know, this anarchist notion, nobody is calling it that, but that's what it is. This anarchist notion of actually abolishing the police is entering mainstream discourse. And there was actually, you know, an op-ed in the New York Times by a local anti-incarceration, anti-police activist. Her name escapes me. I could look it up for you. Actually, in the New York Times. Yeah,
it's really changing. But then what happens with all the drug arrests, all the evictions?
Calling openly for abolishing the police, not just defunding, but abolishing. So, you know, it's really amazing to see, you know, these anarchist ideas entering mainstream discourse at this moment. How it's all going to actually play itself out is, you know, an open question. We're going to find out. But, you know, a first step, even just as a matter of policy, as a matter of public policy, you know, a first step, which I think, you know, that there could be a basic progressive consensus on is, you know, eliminating the victimless crime of cannabis. And that would, you know, slash arrests immediately and slash the need for cops on the beat and slash the opportunities for, you know, negative interactions between black folk and the cops from coast to coast. It would just slash it immediately. So I actually wrote a piece to that effect. I think it was called Defund the Police, Starting with Cannabis Enforcement for Cannabis Now magazine a couple of weeks ago.
Right. And then if they also stopped enforcement of all other drugs and started perhaps regulating them without it to make sure there's no fentanyl in the heroin. Yeah, that could also slash the rates of arrest and also improve public health.
I support that kind of approach, but I also understand that it's a harder sell. It's more controversial because heroin actually is dangerous.
But enter 2020 and now we're
not dangerous. So, you know, it should be a no-brainer with cannabis. And that, you know, I think is where we should start pushing the conversation.
You sound very conservative, Bill. The Oregon legislature is talking about banning enforcement on decriminalizing all.
I know, but Oregon is ahead of the rest of the country on this by a mile.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
And we still haven't managed to put through Cuomo's promised legalization here in New York State, cannabis legalization here in New York State. Still haven't managed to do that.
That's still not even happening, right?
It failed last year, and obviously it's not going to happen this year. And our you know, medical marijuana program, I hesitate to even call it that because the actual herbaceous cannabis flower is not allowed, you know, only, you know, extracts and tinctures and edibles and stuff like that. It's still a very, very restrictive program.
Gosh.
So,
well, the tinctures are very nice. This is no mess at all involved with the tinctures, you know,
what is
no ashtray? What's that? This is it's in there. Liquid.
Yes.
Bill, you've spent a lot of time in Mexico and other parts of Latin America. And what do we have to learn from the Zapatistas in the current moment and people organizing mutual aid? And I think there might be some bits of more than bits of wisdom to be gleaned for all the organizing that's going on around mutual aid projects right now in the U.S. and elsewhere.
Well, the Zapatista Rebellion of January 1st, 1994, I think really changed the world in ways which are little appreciated today. I think that's really got the ball rolling towards the whole anti-globalization movement that we saw in the years following that. And you talk about, you know, about liberating territory. It never ceases to amaze me that, you know, just like, you know, the whole squatter movement here on the Lower East Side, we actually held territory for a matter of, if you talk about the entire length of the squatter movement, for a period of, you know, more than a decade, we were occupying, abandoned buildings here on the Lower East Side. And, you know, Tompkins Square Park, for at least a period of 3 years, was really kind of, you know, liberated territory. It was really not under the control of the city government. Well, you know, the Zapatistas have actually had a chunk of Mexican territory. There's mostly mountains and jungle, but nonetheless, a chunk of Mexican territory under their control as a liberated zone. For how many years has it been now?
Going right. On and they still, years. And that's still the years. Case.
Still the case. Yes. I mean, it's diminished. It's less territory than it was in the immediate aftermath of the insurrection because, you know, by attrition, the government has taken some of it. But it's still a significant chunk of the state of Chiapas is under the control of the Zapatista movement as a, you know, kind of an autonomous zone and liberated territory, you know, which they're running, you know, under their own system of autonomous self-government and with power flowing up from below through local village councils, et cetera. So, yeah.
Have they, do you know, one thing I haven't read much about is how the Zapatistas have been doing since the massive increase in the whole so-called drug war in Mexico since 2006. Like, have they managed to keep their territory?
They have. They have. And Chiapas is not one of the states which has been worst affected by the narco violence. It's mostly states. Well, there are some states in the South which have been, like Guerrero, which is two states up the isthmus from Chiapas, Oaxaca, Guerrero. That's been, Guerrero's been very, very badly hit. But it's mostly been northern states, Tamaulipas and Chihuahua, which have been, you know, most, gravely impacted by the narco violence. So Chiapas, I mean, obviously there's narco violence everywhere in Mexico now, but Chiapas has not been one of the states which has been hit the worst. You know, it hasn't seen, you know, horrific massacres of the kind that we've seen, elsewhere in Mexico. And we saw massacres in the context of the counterinsurgency back in the 1990s, most famously at Octagal in, I believe it was 97. So, but there hasn't been, you know, these kind of like, you know, narco massacres that you've seen elsewhere in Mexico. So, no, the Zapatistas have not been really affected by that. And they've managed to, to keep their autonomous zones free of both the government and the narcos, which, of course, are forces which intersect with each other, to say the very least.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just seems like when you talk about the fact that the squatters in New York City for years, as well as around Tompkins Square Park, actually held territory. I mean, I think for a lot of people who grew up in this country, it's this idea just seems completely, completely impossible. And like, I mean, the police, to many people, I think, feel like a sort of an inevitability, like something that's impossible to resist. And when I first went to Tompkins Square Park in 1987 or 1988, I mean, I was 21 years old and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. It was totally different from anything I had experienced. And I'd been living in the Bay Area of California for years at that point. But I was young and I grew up in the suburbs of New York and Connecticut and, you know, in Fairfield County, and then seeing it, what was going on one night at Tompkins Square Park, all I remember is a lot of fire, hundreds of riot cops, hundreds or thousands of people fighting with the police, projectiles.
Well, you must have been there on the night of August 6, 1988 then.
I guess so. And then I was there for a few more Tompkins days. And
Square Park riot, yeah.
I guess so. I was near the back, I guess. So I wasn't exactly, I mean, and then a couple of days later, I remember seeing folks with broken bones, broken arms, broken legs, a guy who was known locally as Uncle Jerry. There's another guy named Don. Both of them had broken bones and were in really bad shape. And really,
it was Uncle Don. Uncle Don Yippee and Jerry the Peddler, I think.
That's right. Jerry the Peddler. Yes. Yes. Neither of them fared well in the riots.
Well, Jerry's still alive and kicking.
Good.
We lost Uncle Don a few years ago.
Don died, right? Yeah.
Jerry's still alive and kicking. Yeah, I see him all the time.
But one of the things I remember, and I'm actually going to be talking to him soon, Frank Morales. And I remember years ago, he was talking about how the folks in the squat would just have to have good enough barricades to hold the cops off for an hour. And by the time an hour was up, the word could get out in the local community and a lot more people would mobilize. And frequently the police would retreat. And just the idea, I've seen a lot of police retreating in a lot of different situations since then, mostly in Europe.
Seattle,
Germany, they retreat a lot, but they also don't have, they don't use guns and projectiles. So it's all hand-to-hand combat in a riot in Germany. So it's very frequent that police get their bones broken and retreat, and they don't want to have the use of projectiles because they don't want to escalate the riots there that go on, you know. But it's fascinating, the differences. But I had never seen anything like that in my life, and certainly not in the United States. But I wonder, just, it's not so much a question as like, can you describe the atmosphere when the police retreat?
Well, I mean, you know, you just described it. We had a period of, like I say, around 3 years on the Lower East Side when the police were largely, you know, in retreat. Generally, they had to cede control of Tompkins Square Park effectively. You know, the homeless encampment, which they had been ordered to evict, stayed. So, it was... definitely sort of a heightened atmosphere. It was a heightened sense of reality compared to, you know, what the neighborhood has felt like since then. That's for sure. But as we, you know, as you say, you know, the cycle might be coming around again. I think we're going to be entering a very, very interesting period in this country and in this world in the months to come, with, you know, a lot of potential for really amazing positive things, as well as a lot of potential for really horrific negative things.
Yeah, it can really, it's one of those precipice moments. Things can go in very different directions. Huh? Yeah. Well, I suppose we're reaching the end of the hour, but it's been a great pleasure talking with you, Bill.
And thanks for having me, David.
Oh, thank you. Let's talk again soon.
The requisite plug, anybody who wants to, you know, read more about anything that I've been ranting about here, can go to my website, countervortex.org.
Yes, and it's running on the bottom of the screen for anybody watching this form later, too. Yeah.
Thank you.
Website. Yeah.
And the idea is that, you know, that due to ecological collapse and the descent into a police state and all the other, you know, very foreboding stuff that we've been talking about, the world is kind of descending down into a vortex towards, you know, basically towards collapse of human civilization. And the through our resistance and beginning to, you know, reclaim territory and trying to keep alive some sense of the human spirit, we can try to create a counter vortex and move things in the other direction towards, you know, some kind of a dignified human survival on planet Earth. So that's the idea behind the weird sort of science fiction sounding name of my website, Counter Vortex.
Yeah, I'll get the toilet flushing in the other direction.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Yeah. Create a little bit of counter energy in the other direction. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, excellent. Thanks again, Bill. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Good.
Over and out.
Thank you, everybody out there, for tuning in to my discussion with Bill Weinberg for Fifth Estate Live, which you can hear every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KBOO Community Radio, and elsewhere. You'll find all the Fifth Estate Live episodes at fifthestate.org, where you can also subscribe to the physical magazine or read the latest edition online. You can also find these interviews and my other interviews archived in various places in the Discussions with David playlist at youtube.com/drovix and in audio form at soundcloud.com/davidrovix, at patreon.com/davidrovix, where you can also support my broadcasting efforts and check out lots of other content. Or if you look for This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform. If you're somewhere in the region of Portland, Oregon, please go to artistsforrentcontrol.org and sign up for text notifications to be part of Portland Emergency Eviction Response to help us mobilize against the coming waves of evictions. I just started a crowdfunder for an album project, also known as a musician and audio engineer employment scheme. You can check that out at davidrovix.com/pandemic sessions. Remember, don't pay the rent and don't be afraid of your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. See you soon. Bye for now.